This is Attack and Vista Heat. My name is Ben Hawkes. I'm a student from New Zealand. I'm here today to try and answer a pretty simple question. Given a buffer overflow on the heap, how can we leverage that into arbitrary code execution? But it turns out it's a lot easier said than done. So what I'm going to do here today is to start off with a very brief introduction to the internals of the Vista Heap specifically. Not really from a security point of view, but that'll be really quick. So I got a lot of stuff to get through today, so we're in a bit of a hurry. I understand that not everyone in this room sort of has a background in this area, but this is black hat after all, right? We're at the cutting edge, so I'll do my best to make it accessible to everyone. So after that, I'm going to go through some stuff with generic attacks, which is something I'll come to later. It's kind of a bit different. Then onto the Vista-specific stuff, which is really the focus of this talk here, is the Vista-specific attacks that I've been working on for the last year or so. I'll finish off, if I've got time, look at some ways that potentially we might be able to secure the heap a little, if I've got time. Don't want to give too much away, right? All right. So if you come off with nothing else, this is the important slide, really. This is the summary of what I'm trying to do here today. Historically speaking, we had a really good exploit primitive. It was called unlink, and we had a good time with it for a long time, but these days, this unlink primitive, I'll talk about it a bit more in detail later, it doesn't work anymore. Heap exploits are far, far harder to do these days. But fortunately, we've got this thing called application-specific attacks, and really that's the future of where we're heading as exploit writers, is targeting the application data itself instead of heap metadata. But really it's that third point that I'm here to talk to you today about. That's what I have to do, is prove to you this third point. We're not yet at the point where complex heap implementation attacks should be discarded, right? So that's what I'm trying to do. Now, where do you start? Of course, what is the heap? And formally speaking, really, the heap is just runtime dynamic memory management. It's memory that the application decides at runtime how it's going to use. That's as opposed to maybe at compile time, the compiler deciding, okay, these are the variables we have on the stack or whatever. It's all at runtime. It's all done by the application. So the question immediately becomes, how does the application do that? And we're looking today primarily at these three API calls, heapcreate, heapalloc, and heapfree. There are others for reallocating chunks and things like that, setting information about the heap, but they're not so important to us. These are the focus for us today. So specifically, what are we doing here? Heapcreate, well, it's actually pretty descriptive. Basically, all this is doing is building or initializing an individual, unique heap. So we say, okay, give us a heap, and heapcreate will instantiate all of that for us in order so that at heapalloc and heapfree can specify which heap they want to allocate memory from or return memory to, respectively. The interesting thing there, the recurring theme, if you want, it's going to be a recurring theme throughout this entire talk, really, is this heap handle structure. And really, it is just a structure. If you saw Alex Ionescu's talk, he was talking about handles, and in his context, handles were just like integers, just indexes into a handle table or something. In the heap, it's just a pointer to a structure. So I've got, I hope you can see that. It's just a really short C program. And what it's doing is creating a new heap and just allocating a single chunk on it, all right? So just one chunk. And then after that, it prints out the location of the heap handle and the location of the first chunk that gets allocated. And you can see there, the heap handle, in this instance, remember there is this thing called base randomization. So, but in this particular instance, we have a heap handle at hexadecimal address 950000. And then you can see there also, the chunk is just an offset 7C8 from that heap base. So what that's telling you really is the structure that Heapcreate is building is contiguous in memory in some way to the chunks itself in that heap. So that's quite an interesting point. Just remember that, because we'll come to that later. For now, though, let's have a look at this. Every chunk in Vista has a heap header. It's called heap entry, and it's 8 bytes. This slide is actually only applying to the NT heap. There's something called the low frag heap, which I'll mention in a sec, but for the default heap implementation, this is what the heap headers are looking at. And that's the 8 bytes basically before the pointer that gets returned from heapalloc is the structure. And it's sort of set out like this. You've got the first couple of bytes for the size, and that's just a size describing the data that's going to come in this chunk. The flag's not so important to us. It's just like whether it's allocated or free. But this check something is kind of interesting, actually. It's something new. I think it came in Windows Server 2003. It's something new, and it's actually something that comes up a lot when you're trying to attack a heap entry structure. It becomes a big problem. But I just want to really quickly run through this list of specific changes that Vista has made in regards to security. So the first one there isn't actually a technical security measure. It's something called the low fragmentation heap. Essentially, this is just a logic that is different from the NT heap that gets enabled at some point based on some allocation pattern. And it becomes a problem for guys like me because basically at some point, some arbitrary point in the allocation pattern, the entire way the heap is allocating and freeing chunks changes. Just adds like an entire new level of complexity onto what you're doing. Okay, so encoded heap entry headers. The header I just told you about, it's encoded basically with a random value, exclusive or encoded, and that means that if you corrupt the heap entry header, it's going to be decoded to something arbitrary, something that you don't control or you don't know what it is. And immediately at that point, the checksum that I was talking about before, that is going to fail. Because the checksum ensures the integrity of the first 3 bytes of the heap entry. And as soon as you have that sort of decoding to something you don't control, the checksum will fail. And obviously, one thing that a lot of people have been talking about is the randomized heap bases. It's just one part of the whole address space layout randomization thing. The idea is they're just adding entropy into the base address of the committed blocks that the heap is using. I'll talk about that actually quite a bit more later on in the Vista-specific section. List integrity checks. So I was mentioning that unlink primitive thing going on, and that was an attack against lists, basically. The list removal operation was insecure in a lot of allocators across a lot of different systems, including the early Windows heap. Nowadays, they're pretty good with their lists. They have a lot of integrity checks on them, so you don't get the kind of write for primitive, which is basically a primitive whereby you can overwrite any 4 bytes of memory with an almost arbitrary address to some extent. That last point seems kind of obvious, right? You've got a heap implementation, you detect that something's going on, someone's trying to attack you, you want to exit the process as soon as possible, right? Seems kind of obvious, but no, even now in Vista, that is not enabled by default. Sure, whatever. Good job, guys. So that was just like a really, really brief introduction to some of the internals. I just don't have the time to go fully into how the heap specifically is working. In 2006, the guy who actually wrote this stuff, Adrian Marinescu, did a really, really good talk. So if you want some more context behind what I'm talking about, go check out his slides. They're really informative. But for now, we'll come to this thing called generic attacks, which is basically where we have this assumption where we have a buffer overflow somewhere. Almost always we're talking about buffer overflows on the heap, but not necessarily always. There's some certain circumstances where we can do stuff for other overflows. And the goal in that circumstance is to get arbitrary code execution, which basically boils down to controlling the EIP register. So I've got this quote here from a guy called Nico Wiseman from Immunity. Generic heap exploitation approaches are obsolete. Application-specific techniques are needed. And that's kind of what I was saying before. Application-specific attacks are the future. But really the question becomes, what is a generic heap exploitation approach? And I believe Nico in this quote is actually talking about the unlink primitive, the list operation, write for primitive. But if you think about what unlink was, it was never completely generic in any sense of the word, because in a traditional kind of attack, you would overwrite some function pointer with some value x, and then that value x, the forward link in that at that place in memory would actually be written to. So you have this situation where you need memory that's both writable and executable. Now, I don't know if you know much about that, but in these days you have something called the NX bit, which is basically where you have a strong enforcement of having memory that is not both writable and executable. So even these days, if we had unlink, we'd still have to be thinking about these problems. And even then, this is all based on the assumption that your allocator is even using list operations. I mean, if it's a bitmap kind of allocator, then you don't have any list to cause an unlink with. So I'm going to change it up a bit. I'm going to say generic means when it works for any heap allocator, regardless of implementation. So the most obvious of which is going to be the application-specific attack. And fortunately, this is actually the only slide I have on the traditional kind of application-specific attacks, because there's guys out there like Nico, Alexander Sodorov, those kind of guys are doing this kind of thing in much more detail and doing a much better job than I could possibly do, and given the scope of this talk. The idea is essentially, though, that you're trying to overwrite some important structure for the application and leveraging that application structure in some way. It's really, really simple, but very effective. So I'm going to move on now to a couple of just basically common sense known attacks that people have actually been using for many years, but it's never been really formalized. So some of you might know these, some of you might not. And the first one, it's just I've given the name, arbitrary free. The idea is, let's say you can overwrite some pointer as returned by heap alloc. So you know heap alloc, in this case, actually you don't have to be specifically heap alloc. It could also be malloc or free on Linux, it doesn't matter. But say you have some pointer as returned by an allocator and you can overflow it. Then at that point, good programming practice dictates that at some point that pointer will be freed. You know, you get the whole memory leak situation, you don't want that, so the pointer gets freed. So from that we can build up an attack model based on the assumption that we can free an arbitrary address, and here's how it goes. So first of all, you set X, the pointer that you control, to some chunk Y, where Y is an important chunk. And I say it's an important chunk in the same sense of the word of application-specific attacks. So generally that means it contains something like a function pointer or some other data that you can leverage the control of into arbitrary code execution. Now at that point, the attacker has to force the application to trigger a free on X. And what that does, actually, instead of freeing the original pointer X, it frees the important chunk Y. So Y is now freed, but the application still thinks it's in use, right? So at that point, the attacker can start triggering allocations of the same size of Y, and eventually the allocator will return that chunk Y into some other context in the application, say a variable Z. So you have two things, Y and Z, pointing to the same location but used for different things. So if you can control the way that Z is used, then you can control the context, the contents of that important structure, and at that point, it's game over. So I've got a quick rundown here of the ingredients, if you will, for when this attack applies. Obviously, you have to control the X pointer through some vulnerability. You have to know the address of the Y chunk, and that actually becomes quite a hard problem sometimes. It's the kind of thing that keeps me up at night. I've got a few suggestions there, partial overwrite, info leak, heap spray. I'm actually going to talk about two of those three things, well, actually all three of them, actually, if I get time, later on. That third point, contain any deallocation corruption to Y, basically that's saying in a normal allocator, when you free a chunk, the first 8 bytes on a 32-bit system get used as forward and backlinks for the free list. If that is going to change the way the important structure is used in a way that you can't control, then you may not be able to use this technique. But that's really an application-specific point. Those last two are kind of obvious. You have to control the contents of Z, and you have to be able to leverage the important structure. So it has to have a function pointer or something along those lines in it. So moving on. Well, double free. It's 2008 and we're still talking about it. It's probably one of the most misunderstood bug classes ever. Originally, or traditionally speaking at least, it was an attack against the heap implementation. The idea, you see the pattern there, free free, so you trigger a double free and you end up with two instances of the same chunk in the free list. The idea is then you allocate one, so free free alloc, into the application to overwrite the forward and backlinks. And at that point, the second allocation for the second instance of the chunk on the free list will cause an unlink. Of course, no more unlink, that doesn't work anymore. But in some cases, you can get this sort of adjusted scenario where if you can get an allocation interleaved between the two double frees, then you can build an attack model. And like I said at the bottom, it's not always possible to get this interleaved allocation thing going on. So only a subset of double frees are only going to be exploitable. But if you can do it, the assumption there is you can, we can do this. Trigger the first half of the double free. Then before the second double free, you allocate that chunk X that just got freed into the application, into a chunk Y. Then the second half of the double free is triggered by the attacker, hopefully in some form that is reasonably easy to control, and that will actually end up releasing the chunk Y. Now you have that situation where the application thinks Y is in use, but the heap implementation thinks it's free. So again, you can trigger some more allocations and get the same chunk X allocated into the application in a different context Z. So we're not done yet. At that point, you have the situation where you have Y and Z in the application with pointing to the same address, essentially. They're the same chunk, but used for different things. So the idea is you can make either one of them hold some important structure, again, in the same sense of the application-specific stuff, and then ensure that the other one is controlled by you, the attacker. And by doing so, obviously, you control the important structure. There's a lot of issues, though. It's a very application-specific technique. If you think about the kinds of double free bugs that you see, they're either in a local scope or a global scope. And in a local scope, you're kind of limited. You have less chance of getting that interleaved allocation. In a global scope, it's slightly more likely, but local double frees are actually slightly more common, I'd say. So basically, like I was saying before, only a subset of these bugs are ever going to be exploitable. That last point is kind of obvious. If the important structure isn't initialized out of Y or Z, then you're not overwriting anything important. So, of course. Run through that quickly. We'll go for time. I'm not too bad. Okay, cool. So, yep, you need the interleaved allocation for double free, and that allocation, it has to be meaningful. So, there might be some circumstances where you can get an allocation interleaved, but it's not either an important structure or a structure you can control. It has to be one of those two things. And obviously, those last two points are what we're talking about. You have to control one's usage and be able to leverage the control of the important chunk. I've got a little point down at the matter, down the bottom there, that is kind of quite cool. Address-based layout randomization doesn't actually affect anything up until the point where you have control of the IP. So before then, everything is relative. Everything is a matter of allocation pattern as opposed to absolute address. So that's quite cool. It's quite useful, actually, and even in the modern world with all these fancy new techniques for securing processes. So, let's get on to the main focus of this particular talk. The next, pretty much the rest of this talk is all about platform-specific attacks against the Vista heap allocator itself. I have this quote here from Alexander Sodorov. Methods for bypassing the heap protection exist, but they require a great degree of control of the allocation patterns of the vulnerable application. And this quote is actually from ages and ages ago. It was actually kind of foreshadowing the kind of research I'm doing now. Another way to put this is from Noir from ImmunitySec is, I can make strawberry pudding with so many prerequisites. And that's true. It does get very complex, but I believe it is still possible, given a recipe, if you will, to perform this kind of attack, it can become easily possible. I'm sure there's some people in this crowd who know how to make strawberry pudding. I'm going to start off with something that isn't specifically an attack to get arbitrary code execution, but we kind of need some context for a lot of the attacks that will follow. So I'm going to talk about how address-based layout randomization is performed in Vista. And basically, this is the pseudocode from HeapCreate that is doing the randomization of the heap base. At the first step, you're adding 5 bits of entropy to a random pad, and that is like the size of the reserved region. Basically, a random size plus the default size of a heap segment, that gets reserved, and then at point three, they free the random amount. It's kind of a weird way of doing that, because you end up essentially like having a massive reserved range, and then you knock off all the reserved bit and just keep the bit at the end and commit that for your heap. It's a strange way of doing it, but it's actually quite effective. There's nothing theoretically wrong with this. But if we move on to this, segment allocation. So segments are basically what get created when a heap gets filled initially. So every time the heap becomes full from too many allocations, they just say, okay, give me some more committed memory somewhere. And if you look at how they're doing it, there seems to be something missing. Same thing, large chunk allocation. All right, so large chunks are basically a request to heap alloc where the size is greater than 512 kilobytes. They basically say, okay, instead of using the NT heap, let's just give them a committed range of memory themselves and set up a little bit of accounting and then just be gone with it. again, something's missing from that. And obviously, for segments and large chunks, there is no actual randomization in them. The heap bases are randomized, but segments and large chunks aren't. Basically, what that means is they're linearly allocated in the first region that is possible for them to be put in. That's up to NT-allocate virtual memory. What happens is they are still affected by the random base because of that, but there's no more entropy added to these addresses by segments and large chunks. So you get a situation where you can sort of heap spray using these segments and large chunks without introducing more entropy or more variability to the addresses that you're targeting. So I'll just talk briefly about heap spray because it is kind of useful for similar stuff we're doing. I'll just skip this slide, it's not too important, just some stats. The important ones, segment sizes are 16 megs, large chunks greater than 512. But here's a bit of theory, actually. I think it's a good theory. It actually works in practice. So the idea is to find this average Y. And Y is the average, at the point just before you begin the heap spray, Y is the average of the final page that is in any heap allocation. So basically, at the point that you begin a heap spray, there's only going to be sort of a fixed allocation pattern. And that allocation pattern itself can only introduce a limited or discrete amount of variability into the address itself. So you can find this Y average, and it has a relatively low variability. And the idea is that once you have Y, and so you'll find Y by repeatedly or consecutively testing it and looking at what is the last page in the heap range. Once you've found that Y value, you can spray this amount Z. And the minimum Z is around 16 megabytes. And once you spray that amount, you know with a probability approaching 1 that Y plus Z over 2, or the Y value plus half of what you spray, is going to point to your data. The thing is, you don't know exactly where in the heap spray range you are, but you just know you are going to hit the heap spray somewhere. Because it doesn't actually matter where in the heap spray you are in most cases, as long as everything is aligned. Yeah, cool, whatever. But things have changed, right? In the old days, we were heat spraying shellcode. But with the whole kind of NX-bit and non-executable pages and stuff, we shouldn't be focusing on spraying shellcode. The idea here is more where we're introducing heap spray for structural reasons, to set up structures that we'll use later on in an attack. So that's why we care. So let's move on to a real attack now. The first thing, the most obvious thing perhaps when you're looking at this, is the lack of guard pages. Now, a guard page is just like an uncommitted, guaranteed to be uncommitted page before the beginning of any committed range of heap. Like the stack and Vista, all guard paged up. The reason I believe that they don't have guard pages in Vista is because of the randomization kind of introduced like an effective guard page. It seemed like there was a guard page, but really what happens, just, I've got a little thought experiment here really. Consider a heap spray of around 1.5 gigs or whatever. Say you're trying to fill the entire 32-bit address space, the user space. What happens then is actually those segments I was talking about before, when they can't find a place to put themselves in, they reduce their size and try and squeeze into all the little gaps. And so eventually you get the situation where you have just this massive, large, contiguous kind of block of writable memory. And it's like basically the entire heap is all there, potentially with things that you can overflow, because there's nothing stopping you from overflowing from one page to the next page to the next page. So that's what I'm saying here. Potentially you can overflow anything in any heap. It doesn't even matter if it's not on the heap you're overflowing, right? You can overflow application data from different heaps. So that's kind of cool. Like if you're doing an application-specific attack, but you can't find anything in your heap, do a spray and find some application data in some other heap. There's still some questions around how to position everything there, and I'll come to that later. Also, segment, chunk, and bucket headers. Basically, that's saying any structures used by the heap itself, they're all potentially accessible. And the last one there, heap handles. So, potentially, we can control the structure that is described in a heap. That's really, really useful. Because it turns out that the heap handle is basically the most important structure for a heap. It does all of these things, free list, heap canary, flags and tunable options, and a bunch of other, basically it's describing the entire state of that particular heap. So it would be a really good thing to control, right? So the attack model here is kind of like this. The goal is to get the chunk that you can overflow allocated some point in terms of absolute virtual address before a heap handle. Because we're going on the assumption that we have this massive range of memory we can always get from one point to the next. The question is, how do we get that situation? And I'll come to that in a sec. So goal one is get your chunk before the heap handle. Goal two is building a payload for controlling the heap handle in a way that gives us arbitrary code execution. And the way I've done that, and it almost certainly isn't the only way, so there'll be other ways to do this, perhaps even far better ways than the one I've come up with. My way is to control this function pointer called commit hook. It turns out that this function pointer is actually encoded, but as you'll see later, it turns out not to be a problem that it's encoded. And the idea is basically just a function pointer for some instrumentation for when the new segments are created. This function pointer gets called if it's not null and they do some logging and stuff like that. The idea is that once we craft that payload, we will result in direct arbitrary code execution on the next heap alloc using that heap handle. Which is really good because before this, when we were looking at like an unlink or a write for primitive, we didn't get direct execution of arbitrary code. We had to go through some other function pointer somewhere that may be entirely related to the heap. In fact, it almost always was unrelated to the heap. But in this case, we're using a function pointer on the heap directly. So I'm going to go over goal one now. How do we get that situation? And there's actually many potential different ways of doing that. And so I've come up with a few different patterns. And they're basically allocation patterns in order to get a situation where you know you can have this chunk before some heap handle. And the idea is, in pattern one, you spray some fixed amount X. So this isn't the spray of the entire range. This is just some smaller heap spray. And then after that point, if you trigger the creation of a new heap with heap create, so make the application, build a new heap, then actually it turns out that heap is always created after the heap spray area X. So then you can spray the remaining address space, fill up all the gaps and stuff, and then overflow from the initial heap spray area X into the heap handle. So you have to make sure that your overflow chunk can end up in that area X. You might have to do some free and stuff like that. Or actually, importantly, you have to be able to get the overflow chunk allocated after the heap spray, which is not always the case. So I've got another pattern later on that sort of addresses that problem. Once you've done that, you can trigger the allocation on the new heap, and that will be using the heap handle that you can control. And so you overwrite with a payload that I'll describe in a sec, and then you get arbitrary code execution. But the point is, once you can create one heap, why can't you just create many? And keep creating them again and again and again until you just cover the entire address space with heaps, essentially. It's kind of a different take. You're heap spraying with heap create instead of heap alloc, essentially. There is a kind of hidden detail here in that the reserve size and the commit size of the new heaps might not be the same, so you have to make sure that you have some sort of way of making all the pages in each of these heaps committed by some sort of small allocation pattern. That's not always the case. You can find some heaps that have the same commit and reserve size. So once you have that situation, you can just overflow into perhaps one, perhaps many, perhaps all of the heaps. It doesn't really matter. And then trigger an allocation on each of them, and eventually you'll hit one that you control the heap handle of. So that's good. But what if you can't force the application to trigger a heap create? What if you can't make the application build a new heap for you? We have this pattern here, which is basically just spray the entire range. Do a massive heap spray until the point of failure. You have to be able to detect that point of failure, but normally that's okay, as long as the process doesn't end up crashing in some way. Statistically speaking, it turns out that this third to last segment that gets allocated is located directly before the heap handle that you are spraying from, which is really quite interesting. It's weird how it works out like this. I should actually give a caveat here that being a student, I actually have a terrible, terrible test lab. I don't have the kind of capabilities to really get a lot of reliability into some of these claims I'm making. So I'll point out the ones that may actually turn a bit dodgy or something along the way. But I'm doing my best with my resources. Actually, no thanks to Microsoft, I have to say. I emailed them asking them for some help, and they weren't too interested in some no-name guy from New Zealand. But, I'm a bit bitter about that. But so anyway, the point is that it turns out that the chunks that are about 150 kilobytes back from the point of failure on the heap spray are going to be directly before the heap handle. All right. So if you can get your overflow chunk allocated into that little range, then you know with certainty that that chunk is going to be before a heap handle that you can then overflow into and then control with the payload. So those are just three patterns. I only came up with three. Like, there's going to be many others, potentially. It just takes a little bit of thought to think about, given your requirements and your application, how are you going to do this? So again, it comes back to the fact, like what Alexander Sodorov was saying, you always have to know quite a lot of detail about the allocation patterns of the application you're attacking. There's just no avoiding that these days. We're at the point now where you do need that kind of information. So then, let's start to build this payload. Okay, so from offset zero, that's basically a page-aligned offset. The idea is you'd repeat this payload on every page that you are overflowing with a page alignment. All the stuff between zero and decimal offset 68, that stuff that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what that's set to. It's only at offset 68 that things become important. And the whole idea of this payload is basically to carve a path through the heap implementation to the point where we want to get to that function pointer. And it turns out that heap options is a really good way of doing this. So if we just set the two bits in this bit mask, the other ones don't matter, just set these two ones in particular, then it turns out we avoid a whole lot of trouble. So that's actually quite effective, and that's quite possible to do with your average kind of overflow character set. Moving on, the heap canary. So this is the thing I was talking about before, how heap entries are encoded with a random value. That's that value. For us, we just need to set it to a known value. So set it to a fixed constant value, and later on it turns out that it will pass some integrity tests for us in this thing called a free entry, which is not yet. Okay, first of all, we have encode hook. So like I was saying before, the function pointer that we are targeting is encoded, which means it's exclusive ORed with this 32-bit value on the 32-bit system, of course. And essentially, the idea is for us, it will become one half of the EIP that we set in, our arbitrary EIP. And, okay, simple enough. So we know if we want to jump to some value X, this encode hook exclusive ORed with the commit hook function pointer has to equal X. It's not hard to calculate. Here's where it starts to get a bit tricky. This is where the strawberry pudding kind of stuff comes into play. We have this pointer called free entry. So our conditions are to reach the commit hook function pointer, we need to reach these conditions. And free entry has to point to some readable memory such that the hexadecimal offset 0 is null, hexadecimal offset entry 18 points to some other readable memory, Y. All right, so now Y itself is required to have readable memory, sorry, at Y minus 8. So you take Y minus 8, that pointer value at that Y minus 8 value has to be readable, and we have to know the value at that Y minus 8 value is pointing to. In fact, it has to be equal to the heap canary, because that is what an integrity test is used on. So at that point, it's just like, wow, this is massively complicated, what the hell. But it turns out that it's not too hard to manage. So this is another one of the circumstances where I wish I had a kick-ass test lab or whatever. I found this candidate, and I call it a candidate because it might not turn out to work. And it's actually a static read-only mapping, so this isn't randomized at all. And I've only been able to test it on a couple of systems, and I know that there is some degree of change in this mapping, but I believe that there will be enough sort of static information in that mapping to build the structure well enough. And it turns out that the Y minus 8 value for this individual address here turns out that it's going to point to the area of memory that we are heap spraying on, which is good because in the heap spray or even in the overflowed stuff, the stuff we're overflowing, we can control that and we can set it to whatever the value that we set to heap canary to. And I've got one point at the bottom. Even if this candidate doesn't work, or you'd have to do some research to find one that does work for you, we can just set up another heap spray. Okay, so you can chain heap sprays together and just add like y plus z over 2, y plus z plus A over 2, and just keep doing that consecutively. You can queue them up on one on the other and get a pretty good idea. The idea there is that you're doing a heat spray of a structure, not of shellcode. Cool, so similarly, we have UCR entry, which is it's actually next to free entry in the payload, just so free entry is at offset, decimal offset 184, this is 188. And the condition here is UCR entry has to point to memory such that the zero entry is null, and hexadecimal 18 points to some memory Y, such as backlink of Y is readable, and the backlink entry 14 hexadecimal is small. And again, it's just a matter of finding the right candidate for you. I found this one, and I was using it in my exploits, and it was working. Again, you can just set up this UCR entry structure yourself if you need to with a heap spray. And that's pretty much it. It ends with commit hook. So this is just the second half of our arbitrary place in memory that we want to execute by exclusive OR. So that's cool. I got a little screenshot here. Some C code, pretty old school, huh? ITIL was giving me a bit of a grief for still using C yesterday, but whatever. So actually it turns out that there's not much variability in that payload there. In fact, in this sense, the only variability that you have to worry about is what EIP is going to be set to, which is good. It's not too hard to do this. It seems really complicated, and it was actually very, very hard to find a way of doing this, but it actually works quite effectively. So now I'll just run quickly through some of these requirements. Okay, so obviously that's the goal one at the very beginning. We have to control the application to get the kind of chunk layout that we require. The overflow chunk allocated before the heap handle somewhere. That second point can be a bit of a problem. Suffer through a large heap spray. Doing a heap spray of 2 gigs or whatever takes a lot of time. And if you're thinking about like JavaScript or something on IE, IE7 actually has this thing that says, okay, the script is taking a long time, something's going wrong here, do you want to close it or whatever? So that can be a problem. Fortunately, though, the next technique I'll talk about, you can use the payload I just described and not actually have to suffer through the heap spray. So we're just kind of building there, getting to the point where we get some cool attacks. And this is actually a very practical attack that can be used in the real world, I believe. So then, you have to know roughly the position of the overflow chunk. That's saying you have to know where in the page your overflow chunk is relatively. So that's in order so you can align the payload. So you have to zero align the payload or page align the payload to page offset zero. So if you know your overflow chunk is 512 bytes into a 4096-bit page, then you just calculate the difference between them and then start the payload from there. A large enough overflow, obviously you have to be able to reach the heap handle. For small overflows, you can use that third pattern. It becomes quite effective because you know your overflow chunk is going to be very close to a heap handle. And a couple more things, mostly just bookkeeping here, a 32-bit target. So you can't really heap spray a 64-bit address space, right? It's kind of a bit too big. And obviously that is going to be a problem in some cases, but there are the rest of the techniques I'm talking about don't have that requirement so much. So 32-bit for this particular attack, and also control of the character set that you overflow with. So you have to be able to build the payload with enough kind of degree of reliability. Like if you have a Unicode overflow, it becomes a lot more difficult to build that kind of payload. But a standard kind of string overflow or something, you usually can do this, so that's only an issue in kind of weird kind of overflows. Alright, so moving on to the next one. Okay, so I was talking about this arbitrary free stuff before, you know, the whole thing where you have a value that you can control that's been freed, and that was an application specific attack. But if you think about it, the Vista heap is just part of an application. It's fair game, right? So let's have a go. There are always going to be a lot of pointers to heap chunks lying around there just waiting to be overflowed, essentially. The question then becomes, how do you reliably set those pointers to the important structure that's required, the Y structure? And it turns out that we already know a heap handle is an important structure. But at this point, it's like, well, the heap handle, what do you mean? Isn't that meant to be a chunk? Isn't the important structure meant to be a chunk? Surely the heap handle isn't a chunk. But, well, it turns out, unfortunately for Microsoft, the heap handle is a valid heap chunk. Don't ask me why, but it turns out that heap create is internally sets up its own heap entry. All right, so it has it's encoded right correctly, it has a correct checksum, everything like that. And importantly, it's at a known location relative to chunks in that heap. So ASLR, doesn't matter, because we know relatively this chunk from here to the heap handle is at a certain distance. So that means you can do a partial overwrite. So if you knock off the two least significant bytes of some heap pointer and just overwrite it with a 0008, then given the requirement that the pointer is in the first 64 kilobytes or so of the heap, then you know with certainty that this is going to point to the heap handle. Okay? And it's 0008 because remember the whole heap entry thing? The first 8 bytes of the heap entry, then you have the data pointer, and heap 3 wants the data pointer, so we give it 0008. Which is cool, because if you think about like a string overflow, null terminated string overflow, that works. That's fine. So at that point, you can trigger a heap free on X, the original pointer, and that ends up basically freeing the heap handle. So you have like the heap handle floating around in the free list of the heap implementation. Kind of crazy. So of course, at that point, you can just start to trigger allocations of the size of the heap handle, which is 1400. And eventually you get this really, really weird situation where heap alloc is returning its own heap handle. So I've got a screenshot there of that happening. Cool. So, and then at that point, in the same kind of model of arbitrary free, we use the application to overwrite the heap handle with the payload that we were just building before. And at that point, we have arbitrary code execution. So what does it require? Like I said, X has to point to a chunk in the first 64 kilobytes of some heap. That's because if you go beyond that point, the byte that has all the entropy in it from the randomization becomes an issue because we don't know the value of that byte, so we can't partial override it, right? It turns out, though, it's usually not too bad to find either a pointer that's pointing to somewhere in there or finding some allocation pattern that allows you to get the pointer that you can overflow allocated in there. And, of course, sufficient control of Z usage. That's saying you have to be able to overwrite the payload from Z using the application. I got a little note down there. You know, the difference between a heap handle itself and some other segment. So in this attack here that I've discussed, you can't use it on segments, but it turns out that segments themselves actually have a heap entry at offset 0 into the segment. So there's a thing called a UCR structure there. It's used to like link up all the segments and things like that. Potentially, do some research, and you can do it on segments as well. See, I'm just giving things away. All right, so heap termination, that's the stuff I was talking about before, how if you have some corruption on the heap, you want your heap to terminate. In order to do that, apparently, I'm told, this is what you do. I don't know what that does, but apparently it does something good. I found this on the Microsoft website, courtesy of Michael Howard, and right down the bottom, heap corruption detection. It's not that important, is it? No, well, it turns out it kind of is. So you've got an opt-in, like I was saying. It's not on by default. You can check that it is enabled by doing this RTLP disable break on failure cookie. If that's zero, then you know it's enabled. And as it turns out, good job, Microsoft, all the Windows stuff basically does enable that. So kudos to them for that, definitely. So just quickly for all the third-party stuff, I'm not sure, how much time do I have left? All right, cool. Sweet as. Okay, so so third-party stuff is much less likely to enable this. They're usually a year or so behind in this kind of thing. That's why you're seeing like third-party stuff still not compiled with dynamic base and stuff like that. Okay, so off by one, that would be kind of cool. Actually, it's more useful with off by two, but you know, off by one sounds cooler, so you put it up there. Is that exploitable? Well, without heap termination enabled, it is. You have to get this particular layout of your chunk. So the chunk that you can overflow with some value, align it next to some free chunk. And that free chunk itself has to be aligned next to some interesting structure in the same kind of application-specific sense of the word. Now, the free chunk has its own heap entry, and that's what that little thing is pointing to there, and that's what we're going to overflow, essentially, with a couple of bytes, one or two. And what we're going to do is modify the free chunk size to something bigger. Basically, we're going to make it incorporate the interested data in this chunk. And you have to be quite precise with the new size value, otherwise you run into all sorts of interesting things. But you'll see that stuff when you start to play with this technique, or if you do. And then the idea is at that point that you can start to try to allocate that free chunk. And eventually that chunk will be allocated into the application based on request of size, the free chunk, and plus the size of the interesting data. So you make requests of the size of them combined, and okay, so the checksum will fail here because, you know, we're overriding some of the heap entry. The checksum is no longer correct, most likely. But as it turns out that when the checksum fails, they just take the value, the size value, directly. They don't take the decoded size value. So they use your size value that you overflowed with as the size. That's why you can actually get a situation where this free chunk, which we've told it is a lot bigger than it actually is returned to the application. Essentially, you're returning the application a chunk that contains another chunk in itself, and the application is still happily using the interesting structure or whatever, and now you've given the application this other chunk that we can potentially use to overwrite that interesting structure. So this is what we need. Obviously, we can't be opted in for termination on heap corruption, whatever. We have to come up with the whole positioning of things correctly. It's actually can be quite difficult to get that. That's, again, comes back to having a really in-depth knowledge of how your application is doing its allocation patterns. Know the exact sizes of the free and interesting chunks. Well, once you have 0.2, you almost always have 0.3. Sufficient control, that's the stuff I've been saying all day. Control of the return chunk to control the interesting data. So you have to be able to make the application overflow the interesting chunk in some way that we can control. So moving on. Oh yeah, I just threw this in for the sake of it. Say you've got like an information leak, and say you can like only leak a heap entry header, but say that you know the state of that particular chunk, so you know its size and you know whether it's free or allocated, then we can come up with this kind of situation. Looks a bit theoretical and stuff, but L1, L2, L3, and L4 are the four leak bytes. So those are the bytes we leaked from the application somehow. And K1 and K2 are the known size value, so the first two bytes of the heap entry, and K3 is the known flags value. And from that, K1 XORed with K2 XORed with K3 is the known checksum, because that's just how the checksum is computed. And if you XOR them all together, then byte by byte, you get the canary value. Mostly, I think that will probably be useful in situations where you're writing an application-specific attack, but something keeps happening in the application, it triggers a free or something, and crashes you before you can leverage your important structure. But it's just kind of good to know that, and also potentially you can use it to access all these other things reliably. Moving on. So low frag heap. That's the whole thing I was talking about. It's like an entire different heap within a heap. At some point in the empty heap's allocation pattern, this LFH thing gets enabled. And unfortunately, it turns out that when it's been enabled, they create this bucket structure for LFH using RTL allocate heap. Basically, they're saying they're using heap alloc on themselves to allocate something, some really important structure. Well, we already know that we can get some chunks allocated before that, right? So potentially we could get our overflow chunk allocated before this really important LFH bucket structure. Well, okay, sure. What do we do with that? So, all right, so the point here, the LFH is enabled, it turns out, in a relatively deterministic fashion. Once you've found one allocation pattern that triggers the creation of LFH, you can repeat it, basically, and be relatively sure that it will trigger LFH again. So, that's what we're saying, we get our overflow chunk allocated before the LFH bucket, which itself is just a chunk. And all we have to do is knock out the first 24 bytes. So, that's our situation, we knock out the first 24 bytes. But at that point, we have to know that straight after that, we're going to trigger an allocation request of size R. So before the overflow, we have to know immediately after that, there will be an allocation request of a fixed size, because we actually end up incorporating that size R into the overflow payload in some sense. Right. It turns out that not only is RTO allocate heap used to create the bucket structure, it's used elsewhere as well to build these things that are called like user segments or something. And it turns out that really unfortunately, they use the LFH bucket structure to decide the location of the heap handle that is used for that allocation. Well, we already know that if we can control that, we can get arbitrary code execution. So the goal here is to trigger that internal LFH allocation with an arbitrary heap handle. And at that point, we already have the payload that we can just use. So this looks kind of complicated. It's actually not too hard to calculate. We have to set up this value x, and x has to eventually point to some readable memory. Look at the bottom point there. It has to point to some readable memory such that offset 4 into that pointer is a value y. And I won't tell you what y is quite yet. To go back up to what x is or how x is calculated, this is a calculation within RTL allocate heap, and basically it takes the offset 20 into the LFH bucket. So I was saying you're overflowing 24 bytes. That's because you need to knock out offset 20 of the LFH bucket to be a base for x, and then they do this like an index into that base by taking the allocation size that you're triggering plus 8 and then divided by 8 and then subtracting the offset 14 into the LFH bucket and then multiplying that by 4. So it's an index into an array, basically. And it turns out that that array is an array of LFH contexts. So what is an LFH context? Well, it's actually not important what it is, but the idea here is that we need to, again, to craft the path of execution through LFH to the point where they trigger internally RTL allocate heap, we need to do this. We need to point Y to an empty context, which basically means we need to point Y to a bunch of zeros. And as it turns out, it's not too hard to find a Y value that is doing this roughly. For example, you could think about using like the TEB or the PEB, because there is randomization on those, but there's very little, and you end up with slots that are guaranteed to be either a TEB or a PEB. Sometimes you run into the problem where you had a PEB when you really wanted a TEB, but that's not too much of an issue, statistically speaking. So yeah, running through that, I won't talk about that all out loud. Basically, a bunch of zeros, but the point from negative DC from Y has to be the arbitrary value for the heap handle. Another way of looking at that is if you take 100 off Y, the offset of 24 has to be the heap handle. And once you control that pointer, you can just point it to some area that you've heap sprayed with the payload, and that gives you arbitrary code execution. It's actually just adding another layer of complexity, but I think all this kind of complexity becomes manageable the more familiar you become with these techniques. So I'm running through the ingredients again. You have to get the chunk layout correct. So you have to get the overflow chunk before the LFH chunk. Usually not a big issue. Find an appropriate X value. So the value is such that the entry 4 into that X value is pointing to Y. You have to be able to find that. Again, that's really not too hard. There's enough static mappings around that you can find a good enough X value, even if it's just pointing your Y value to somewhere like on the heap that you're going to heap spray. That's not too bad. So finding the appropriate fake LFH context, that's the kind of stuff I was talking about. Maybe you'll use the TEB or PEB. And form a correct heap payload. Okay, that's basically you're going to have to heap spray your heap payload somewhere. Most commonly. Potentially you could use, say you're in a third party application and the data segment of that application is not randomized, you could stick it in there as well. And then you have like you have it at a fixed location, which is good. And reliably trigger an R allocation after the overflow. That's just saying you have to pick the right R value for whatever is first allocated after the overflow, because that's the point that will that first allocation after the overflow is the point where you get the LFH using an arbitrary heap handle. So, moving on. More LFH stuff. Let's say, for example, why not, we're given an overflow where we can write null bytes. I'm just going to throw this one in because it's actually not too common to get that situation, but it is kind of interesting because it's heading towards further attacks against LFH. As a student, I don't have much resources or much time. I'm sure there are many people in this room who are just going to totally decimate LFH. I have that kind of feeling about it. So what do we gain? It turns out that given this kind of overflow, we can apply that off-by-one technique in the same sort of sense of the word, even when you have a terminating heap. So even the default window stuff, potentially you can use this technique on. How does it work? Okay, so as I mentioned right at the beginning, the heap header for the LFH is actually entirely different to the NT heap. It looks like this. You've got the context, which I was talking about just before, in the first four bytes. You also have at offset 6 and 7 an index and a flags value. Now, it would be good if we could just like knock out the context and immediately point it to a zero context or whatever, but there's a checksum on all this stuff, so it doesn't work like that. But it turns out that before any of the checksum stuff, if you set the flags value to 5, it will use index to reposition the actual value that will be freed. So assume you can free an LFH heap entry, or an LFH chunk essentially, that you can control. Alright? If you set the flags to 5 and the context to hexadecimal 2, that's why we have to write the null bytes there, because that context has null bytes in it, then it uses the index to just say, okay, instead of freeing this chunk here, let's go free a different chunk. It's kind of strange, but it's just how the LFH works internally. It's for the sub-segment stuff that they've got going on. Right, so that context is actually just an index into an array of function pointers that is used for some instrumentation, and we have to pick one that will not screw everything up for us. And if you don't pick a value within the range of that array, then it will just get out of it and we'll fail and we won't be able to free anything. So here's what it looked like. We want P prime to point to some other LFH chunk, perhaps a chunk containing some important information. And in order to do that, we take the index, which is the X value, and we subtract it from P. So P prime is equal to P minus X times 8. It's just saying that the index is multiplied by 8 and subtracted from the original chunk P that we're freeing, and P is the chunk we control. So if you think about the calculation, that one byte gives us a range of 2,040 bytes that we could potentially point an LFH, that we can potentially point free to go to free a chunk. So this is the chunk layout we want to get going. We have a target chunk right at the beginning. So that's an important structure inside of an LFH chunk. It has to be an LFH chunk in this case. It can't be an NT heap chunk. And then which between the target chunk and the free chunk, or the freeable chunk rather, we have the overflow chunk. So the idea is we overflow from this chunk into some chunk that is allocated but we know we can free. So at that point, the target chunk and the overflow chunk, of course, have to be combined within that 2,040 byte limit. So they have to be fairly small chunks. So unfortunately, if you have an overflow from a large chunk, then it may not necessarily work in this case. So here's what happens. When you knock out the heap entry of the LFH, it ends up telling it to go over to the target chunk and free that instead. So at that point, you can just simply reallocate that information, interesting chunk, back into the application and use the application to free that. Use the application to overwrite that important structure. Which is good, because at that point, you have control of some function pointer, you have arbitrary code execution. All right. Some more ingredients, if you will. We have to have the ability to write null bytes in the overflow. And you have to have a small target and overflow chunk. So they have to be combined in size less than 2,040 bytes, and they have to be on the LFH, because it just doesn't work if you're pointing an LFH chunk into some other non-LFH chunk. Because it does actually turn out that you get a bunch of NT chunks and LFH chunks all in the same kind of committed range of memory. You do get that situation quite a lot. And of course, we have a pretty strict kind of layout that we need, so we need to be familiar with the application to get that required allocation pattern. And again, we have to be able to leverage the control of the reallocated target chunk. So we have to be able to leverage the important structure. All right, so turns out I do have some time. Oh, future techniques. That could be interesting. So like I was saying, I've only really scratched the surface of what's out there in the Vista Heap. This is sort of the first... Well, actually, it is the second. It's Richard Johnson's work on the Vista Heap that he presented at Talk on. And now this is like the second wave of attacks against the Vista Heap, publicly at least. So there's some areas that I think are looking good for the future. Attacks on heap-free, particularly in regards to list operations. So I've been talking about how the focus of my talk isn't lists, that I suspect that there are going to be list operations and more subtle kind of list attacks that will be coming out. Basically areas where the lists are used in ways that haven't been expected or studied before, particularly in heap free. So a lot of my emphasis has actually been on heap alloc. If we look further into heap free, we do still get a lot of trouble with the checksums on the heap entries. They are a big, big hurdle to forming a successful exploit, but I think there is room to move in there. More attacks against the LFH. So the LFH is a very, very complicated piece of software, and it's using a lot of very advanced structures, and I've honestly only really scratched the surface there. The stuff I found is like, as soon as you look at LFH, you'd see this kind of stuff. And UCR structure overflow. So the UCR structure is actually located in two places in any given segment. There's a structure at the very beginning of a segment and a structure at the very end of a segment. And of course, if you have an overflow somewhere in the middle of that segment, you can reach the UCR structure at the end of the segment. And that could potentially be very useful. For example, Richard Johnson did release a technique against the UCR structure at the end of the segment. In my research, I found that that particular technique was prevented by the checksum on the UCR structure there, because basically his technique was what happens is the UCR structure gets rewritten when the heap gets extended. Basically, extending means when you're going from a committed block and using some of the reserved space for that heap. And the idea was that the UCR structure would get rewritten, and he could choose where that UCR structure was rewritten to and trigger a partial override of something to control some value. But I found that I couldn't get that one to work because of the checksum on the heap entry for that UCR structure. Your mileage may vary. You may have found that it works for you. Okay, so let's move on and have a look at a few things you could do potentially to secure the heap. Specifically against my techniques, sure, why not, and potentially against future techniques as well. So I'm going to start off with the specific stuff and get more theoretical as time goes on. There's only a few slides left, so it's okay. All right, so one of the most obvious ones would be to add guard pages, because that removes the whole risk of potentially overflowing from one heap segment to the next. And really, there's no reason not to, because a guard page is so computationally efficient that there's no overhead involved in doing this. It's not causing trouble with the allocator itself at all. It's just completely separate. That second point there, remove internal use of RTLP allocate heap. That's something that I believe quite firmly in. Basically, an allocator should never use itself to allocate structures that it will be using. The allocator should only ever be used by an application, not internally. So the idea would be is you should move some of those structures that are being allocated internally to some other specified mapping that is guarded itself. So basically taking all of that, all of those structures out of band from the heap. So they're no longer reachable by an overflow. Ensure the checksum is always validated before any use of chunk headers. Yeah, that's a good one, because the reason that that last LFH technique worked was because you could actually do things with the heap entry before the checksum was checked. So there's basically a point in time where the checksum on the heap entry or the LFH heap entry is checked, and you know at that point that the integrity is either good or bad. But before then, there's potential to do stuff, and we don't want any potential to do stuff in there. I should have actually added one more up here, and that would be, don't make the heap handle a valid heap entry. Why would it ever be a valid heap entry? Why? It's not a chunk. It shouldn't be a chunk. So those three or four things would probably more or less have addressed all of my techniques. I mean, these are fairly simple things, right? There's no reason that they shouldn't have been done already, or they couldn't be done in the future. I hope they aren't done in the future. It means I have to find a bunch of new techniques. So generically speaking, so stuff that might help in the future. Add randomization to segments and large chunks. Basically that's saying at the moment we can rely on the fact that there's no more entropy added by segments and large chunks to do some pretty specific heap spraying. As soon as you add more randomization, the heap spraying becomes more complex, and you can't do that whole y plus z over 2 thing, because the variability of each y becomes just so large, it's just not feasible. Or basically, the more variability on y that you get, the greater that your z value has to be. So at the moment, the z value is trivial, but later on, it might not be. Increase the amount of address entropy. I mean, that's kind of a thing that I'm sure they're looking at doing. I've heard that they're just sort of taking it conservatively to begin with only 5 bits of randomization, which is really not much at all. So that's something that I expect will happen. Increase the size of the checksum. Yeah, probably doesn't matter too much. One thing I was looking at was collisions on the checksum, and basically I came up with an idea whereby if you had like a wormable bug or something, and a situation where you could only write an exploit when the checksum succeeded, then potentially, if you think about the maths of the checksum colliding, you get a collision every 1 in about 65,000 times. So if you're attacking millions and millions of hosts, you get thousands and thousands of successful attempts. But as soon as you start to increase the size of the checksum, that probability dwindles to nothing very quickly. Encode all of the chunk. Again, that's kind of stuff like maybe an LFH. If they had encoded the full 8 bytes instead of just the first 4 bytes, then that could have given me some problems. And it's always a good thing, I believe, to reduce the use of list operations, because they are potentially very easy to get wrong. Personally, I'm a fan of allocators that use a lot of bitmaps, and a lot of really good research has been done in that area, and I think can be a very effective technique for allocators, just not from a security point of view, but also just from an efficiency point of view. All right, so last slide. Here's some theory. This is like stuff that will probably never happen, but it'll be kind of interesting to see how it work. Remove all metadata structures from anywhere in the heap. Basically, that's saying have no heap entry, have no heap handle, have no buckets, no segment structures, anywhere accessible by a chunk, by overflow. Basically, you move all of that stuff into some other guarded mapping. And people have actually already done this. A guy called Yves Yunan, I believe, wrote an allocator for glibc that did exactly that. And it had no particular, in his results, no particular performance impact, and has a great security impact. So, the idea would be in that circumstance, it's still good to have canaries between the chunks, because canaries are a really good way to detect heap corruption. So, even if they're not encoding anything, it's still good to have them there just so you can check that they haven't been corrupted in any way. And that's more for protecting against application-specific attacks. The more that those canaries are checked, the more likely that the application will end before you can leverage your important chunk. And again, to protect a little bit more against application-specific attacks, you should have much smaller segments and many more guard pages. The smaller segments in particular is important because it means that there will be less things allocated after your overflow chunk. So less a chance of you having an important structure after the chunk that you can overflow. And this fourth one has been suggested many, many times before by a variety of different people, is to introduce true non-determinism to allocated patterns. That's basically saying that given 1,000 allocations and 1,000 frees, every time each of those chunks will go into a different relative offset somewhere. So the first chunk might be allocated at an offset of 100, but the next time you allocate that first chunk and the next time you execute that program, it'll be allocated at an offset of 4,000 or something. And as soon as you do that, the complexity of finding your important chunk is just so, so high that it becomes really, really problematic. And I say there, you still have to ensure some locality. That's kind of a performance issue. Kind of like people talk about cache locality, you also want chunk locality, because it turns out that chunks that are allocated at the same sort of time are also freed at the same sort of time. They go together really well. But yeah, it'll be great to see that one day, because I think it's actually not too difficult to do. And I know that actually OpenBSD did look at doing a little bit of this kind of stuff for a while. So, any questions? Don't be shy. All right, cheers guys.